And so they've been asking for compensation and many other things. The 30 by 30 then just turned that into, in my opinion, kind of the sacrifice zones of the global south of indigenous lands to parks, preservation. So it's another sort of land grab, taking land from indigenous people. That it was an issue at COP15. Yeah, how many minutes do I have left? Wrap it up. Okay, go 1 minute, 2 minutes. So that it was an issue at COP15, it was too little too late. It's created by a colonial structure. That structure's not working if you're going to include in traditional ecological knowledge. The ecological knowledge of indigenous people globally know how to live with the land. I was going to tell a cool story, but basically I'll try to wrap it up and say that if I have 5 years of driving a car and I'm out to shop for a car and I'm pretty familiar with cars. I've been driving for 5 years. I've driven three or four of them into the ground. But yet, my friend over here, she's been driving cars for 50 years, and she's got the same car, and she's been living with it. And I can't quite understand her because she talks about that car with a language of animacy, a grammar of animacy. Like the car's alive, like it's a living thing. And that she's part of the car. You know, she has this relationship with the car. And that relationship, she's part of it. The problem with the colonial system that created the 30 by 30 is that it is alive. The land is alive. We are a part of the land and the natural world. And if we're creating a structure that is a colonial structure to fix the damage that we've done, we're coming at it from the wrong end. So we've got to come from the bottom up, turn the leadership over to indigenous people who have been driving the cars for 50 years and kind of get that they're a part of the natural world as opposed to a separate from it. Whereas the colonial structure, the car is just a tool. Extraction industries, all of those things. So I think I'm out of time. I have a lot more to say.
Thank you so much. So we have three, obviously, different perspectives here. And I would like to just kick it off with one quick question, then I'm going to turn it over to you. But I am interested in picking up on this. There are a lot of elements to CBD, and we can talk about the means of compensating countries for the genetic resources found within their borders. but for the moment, I do want to pick up on the 30 by 30 because it's the most well-known of the results. And let me just, so one of the things that I found interesting at ECBD was that there was a proposal, which was not accepted, by the way, but it was a proposal by the African Union. And the African Union, which of course represents many very biodiverse regions, biodiverse countries, proposed that there be a 1% tax on, I called it a tax, and then the ambassador from Namibia said, it's not a tax, man. I can't imitate his accent, but it's not a tax, man. It's a compensation for all the resources that have been taken out of Africa for all these years, and don't call it a tax. But I'm self-correcting myself here, but they proposed a 1% fee on all products emanating from genetic resources in Africa, which is really amazing. Idea, of course, which would essentially be everything. that approach was intended to both compensate African countries for the resources within their borders and to provide a very important mechanism for preserving those resources by actually establishing a cost to foreign companies that were there. I suppose a roughly similar model. That proposal was not accepted by the overall United States. 30, what are the interests that are arrayed around this question? Which 30% do you take out of commission from traditional economic development? And how do you, if you do, recognize the role of people? I love this image of our two buddy cousins. Kind of conceived of before we say that, but two buddy fellow cousins who live in these areas. And the scientific component to that. So I'd like to, why don't we just go in this order, Chip, why don't you just address the kind of diplomatic questions here, or however you'd like to address this question, the potential pitfalls and possibilities of 30 by 30, then kick it over to Dallas, and then Bethany, I'd love to bring it on, and then I will kick it over to you guys.
Well, you know, my former boss in the State Department, he was the in charge of environment, and he chaired a lot of the Paris Agreement stuff, and very smart guy, Andrew Snyder, and he said to me once, I said, God, I'm so busy with all these things, and he said, that's because you're trying to do everything. Our job here is to deal with lose-lose situations. If it's a win-lose situation, you won. That's, go tell the journalists that you won. That's fine. I'm not going to do anything about it. If you lost, you lost. Move on. If it's a win-win situation, you won. That's for the public affairs people as well. You don't have to worry about that. Our job is when there are two really bad choices and choosing which one is less bad. And that's a lot of what you see in these UN agreements. I mean, the UN was formed for, you know, a pretty good reason in the beginning. It was after World War II and all that. And, but it's really clunky and it's really hard to get things done. And a lot of idiotic things happen in one country in a very self-serving way. And the United States has been in this place a lot. Lots of other countries too can block everything. And you end up with these kind of bad compromises. And what we got at COP15 is not perfect. I mean, I would have written it differently. You know, but it's the best that we could get. And the alternative was not to get anything at all, you know, and just to have things going on as they are. And the question was, can you use that as a foundation now for actually doing some of these things, for the effective recognition and protection of indigenous territories, you know, to actually self-managed? Can you, you know, stop people from drilling for oil in places where it really shouldn't be happening? All, you know, all these kinds of things. Maybe we can use it that way. But this is kind of my point. And it's up to journalists and advocates and others to hold governments accountable to actually do the right thing and not try to cut corners and do stupid things like fake restoration and things like that. And so there's a big job ahead. It's just the start of it. And it's only 7 years on these targets. This is not like something vaguely, you know, in the far future.
I guess I'll talk about something that I know about. If we're pulling out chunks, and as I mentioned earlier, these are arbitrary lines. If we're doing ecological restoration, we have to, in my opinion, we have to go back to the people who had been living in that place for 2,000, 5,000 years and look at their traditional ecological knowledge of how that place operates, and it doesn't operate within those borders. So let's take Yellowstone National Park, wild bison. There's only one herd of wild bison left. And now that could be, if you're restoring arid grasslands in Kenya or Cambodia or in Mexico, it's the same story. It's just whatever that local environment is and the people who've been living there for their entire last 10,000 years. So it doesn't really matter, but I'll take the Yellowstone National Park. So, what we're proposing and what we're wanting to do, and Deb Haaland, Secretary of Interior, who'll be here on Friday, kind of thinks this is a good idea. She gave $25 million to it for tribal co-management of wild bison, the only herd of wild bison in the park. 6,000 of them, well, now 4,000, because 2,000 of them were killed by poor colonial management, largely captured by the livestock industry in Montana, who don't want bison. So if you put tribal leaders in charge of managing wild bison, they will bring the numbers up. Carrying capacity of that 2.5 million acre national park at West Yellowstone is 11,000 bison. We're at 6,000. That should be the minimum floor. 11,000 should be the floor, because that's the ecological carrying capacity for Yellowstone National Park. But guess what? They can't walk outside the park because there's an arbitrary border there. So we're not, this 30 by 30, setting aside these parks, kicking out the indigenous people who live there so that we can reduce our carbon, load is a disaster, in my opinion. So you manage bison the way bison should be managed 500 years ago. They get to walk outside the park, walk around on all that BLM and Forest Service land that belongs to everyone in the U.S., and we get to enjoy the bison. They get to help with their ecological piece of restoring that. We could put wild bison on their turf, on their historical ranges, in numbers that will help that whole ecological system. So give that leadership to indigenous people, and then they can help the Forest Service, as bison walk outside the park, in their normal migratory patterns, and still have that genetic wild diversity of the bison. And I'll stop there, but that dive just keeps going deeper and deeper and deeper into ecological restoration. If you're managing to prevent loss of biodiversity and manage for the restoration, the ecological restoration and overall ecological health of a particular ecological place, which is bigger than the borders of Yellowstone National Park.
Thanks, Dallas. I guess I'll start, 30 by 30 is about protection, and I think one of the things to answer your initial question is that the CBD states in the opening of the agreement that 17% of terrestrial lands are already protected globally. So we're actually only talking about 13% more. We're not talking about 30%. There's a half-Earth proposal out there. That'd be 50%. It's probably what we need. But I think it's important to recognize that if you ask this question, how are we going to get there? We're not starting from zero. Okay, we're starting from 17% terrestrial and 10% marine. So we have a bigger hurdle on the marine side. And I think that another piece to think about from the fair and equitable question is looking at and understanding principles and getting outside of some of that colonial perspective. So from, I know that this is a question about conservation, but I think there's a lot of principles about how to do conservation appropriately and in a more equitable manner. And from a restoration perspective, we have principles for how to implement restoration. And the first one is that it should involve all stakeholders, and the second principle is that it draws on all types of knowledge, including traditional ecological knowledge, local ecological knowledge. And we have to recognize that one of the things we do a lot in the United States and that gets exported to the rest of the world is this idea that people and nature are separate. And I think that's part of what Dallas is talking about as well. So when we talk about 30% protected areas, does that mean protected from people? Or does it mean protected from unsustainable extraction? And so if you look at that restorative continuum, I think there's a very significant opportunity to operate on the left side of the continuum and in the center of the continuum to have people as part of nature, because we are part of nature. And we shouldn't be, if we try to take people out of nature, we're not going to succeed. And not just from an indigenous perspective, from a non-indigenous perspective as well. And so I think those are some of the pieces that we have to think about. And in that context, and I should let Dallas talk about this, not me, but from an ecological restoration perspective, we also talk a lot from our indigenous partners that we learn from about reciprocity. And so this idea that what we give to the planet gives back to us, what we give to the earth gives back to us. When we take and don't give, we lose. And so that also comes back to some of these questions about conservation, and I think it was maybe something that Chip said, or maybe it's also looking at the car analogy that Dallas said, but we have to measure, our economic systems still continue to not measure the cost of the resources that we use. And that's another piece that we have to start dealing with on the conservation side as well, on the 30 by 30 side, if we want to have a balance sheet that works. There's a fabulous 5-minute New York Times video about this that came out a couple weeks ago that I encourage everybody to watch. But the analogy that's used in that is that if football teams only counted the goals that they, the touchdowns or soccer, football, the goals, if you only count the goals that are scored, that you score, and you don't count the goals scored against you, you're always going to win. That's how our economic systems work, right? That's what this great video, 5 minutes, I think everybody should watch it, says. It's not new information. We know this, right? But this is what we do. We only count in our economic systems what the money, and we don't count the environment. And so we have, and we're only putting our scores on the map. And that is part of, you know, how do we get to 30 by 30? We have to start counting everything. And we have to have people in that equation and culture, cultural restoration, social restoration, human health and well-being restoration, ecological restoration, and conservation together.
Okay. Thank you. Some things to think about. Let's open. Would anybody here have possibly a question for people on the panel here? And we can open it up to discussion. What's that? Okay, we can pass this. So if you have a question to dive, we've kind of given the big picture here. So if you want to get into more specifics, we're here.
Hi, yes. So I'm Ian James. I'm a reporter with the LA Times, and I was interested in asking about just you mentioned about counting and how difficult, you know, how much disagreement is there about how these things are counted? And I'm especially thinking of some of the carbon pay for restoring forests programs that in various cases haven't worked out the way they're intended. So be interested in the discussion of that subject. Thanks.
I can start. I'm guessing Chip will have some comments on that too. I think that there's a couple things I'll say from a counting perspective. And again, I'm more an expert on ecological restoration than on conservation. But one thing I can say is there's a lot of environmental economics work happening. And there's also a lot of work looking at ecosystem services and the value of nature for people, and nature's contributions to people, and that's referred to as NCPs, nature's contribution to people. And I think that one of the weaknesses in the ecosystem services space right now is that we don't have very good tools still, and this has been several decades that we still don't have very good tools for counting the return on investment when you invest in restoration. So if you spend $1 million to restore a place, and that place then provides a bunch of additional ecosystem services, can you count that effectively? And that counting tool, that economic tool, is still in its infancy. They have a lot of tools to measure nature's value for people, nature's, the economic value of natural systems. But to measure the return after you restore it is still in its infancy, and there's a lot of work going on in that space right now. And I think I should just let Chip. Do you want to comment on
about this one here? Well, it's an interesting question at the nexus of the whole carbon and climate stuff and biodiversity stuff. Since Mark mentioned that one of the big issues here is who's going to pay for this? A lot of us in the global south, if they're poor countries, you can start doing conservation. Even countries that want to do it, where's that? I believe it's $200 billion a year is what is actually in the agreement. I mean, that money's not there, but there's a commitment to having that. So everyone is looking at the carbon model and the carbon markets as a way to get that money. Can we build biodiversity into carbon trading, things like that, and so we can get the private sector to pay for a bunch of this stuff? And, well, let's look to the philanthropists. Let Bloomberg and Bezos, those guys pay for it. They have these big foundations and things like that, which is, to me, kind of ironic. And, you know, full disclosure, we get money from the Bezos Earth Fund, and all that is, as do a lot of people. But if those people had been taxed in the beginning, the states would have enough money to do this stuff themselves. They wouldn't have to go begging to these billionaires to pay their fair share of taxes, So but that's the world that we are actually in now. But so this idea of imposing the carbon market model on biodiversity is really popular right now. I'm talking about biodiversity credits and things. And I think it's really not going to work because biodiversity doesn't have any unit of currency. There's no metric tons of carbon equivalent. There's no agreed metric, and you can't trade it. It's not fungible. It's not like you know, three buffaloes for four rhinos. You know, it's like, it doesn't work that way. But that is what is a lot of the mainstream solutions are about, imposing that sort of carbon market. And to be fair about it, the whole other discussion, the whole idea of carbon markets and offsets and all that has not worked out so well either. It's been like 15 years people have been trying to do that. So the idea of imposing that kind of a model on biodiversity, to me, I think, is far better.
One of the other things, coming back to what Chip said, is that we need to look at how businesses, and this is a great question for you guys to ask when you're talking to global corporations, like Fortune 500 corporations, they have supply chains. Those supply chains rely on nature. And so how many businesses, not out of philanthropy, but out of their own enlightened business self-interest, are investing in restoration or conservation so that they have a supply chain to continue to make their profits? That's part of that accounting that needs to happen. And that's where we need to start moving.
Yeah, that's a great question. And like Chip says, you know, trying to monetize biodiversity is kind of a hard formula. In talking about the carbon market and biodiversity, I'll just say this. Let's say, I mean, we get into the my science can beat up your science kind of deal. If we're restoring arid grasslands around the world, well, first of all, what if we happen to be managing forests around the world really poorly and not looking at ecological restoration, and we're not planting those citrus trees because we want to sequester carbon, but that's messing up all sorts of other things, including communities. So if we're doing poor forest management, that's a problem. If we're doing arid grassland restoration, that's a carbon sequestration, gold mine, really, because that carbon then goes into the soil if you get those arid grasslands in a really healthy state. If you're planting forest or doing bad forest, so if those grasslands burn, where's that carbon? Most of it stays in the soil. If you're doing poor forest management, and so how do you calculate that, right? If you're doing poor forest management and you're trying to sequester carbon in forests and then those forests burn, where does that carbon go and how do you calculate that and what's the value of that or the negative value of that?
Great, thank you. Now I'm going to think, interesting, I'm going to add another twist to this just to twist things even further in the complicated direction. Is one of the initiatives that we haven't talked about yet was the way that traditional ecological knowledge in genetic resources can be compensated. And that was one of the initiatives that came out of the CBD, was the way that, for example, people are familiar probably with the whole principle of biopiracy and the notion that you had rich country companies coming down to biodiverse countries to come back with plants and animals and bring them back and turn them into drugs or foods or cosmetics or whatever it might be. So for the very first time in history, the UN determined that we will set up a system to begin to acknowledge the sources of that material. It's a fascinating arena. I will confess I'm working on it myself, so I won't say everything, but I do think there's an enormous arena here to look into, which is essentially how the mechanism that is now being debated, it's actually being debated right now, how to set up a system for providing funds back to those communities where they come from. And what it also further complicates is then you have a specific community, for example, the Amazon or wherever it might be, or in the Republic of Congo, and often that ecological knowledge, Dallas well knows, is not limited to one particular tribal community, but the UN has to identify who is it that's responsible, and so in a way there's like a strange kind of inventory being formulated now around this question. Just to throw a little twist into this discussion even further. Okay, any other questions? Yeah, could you identify yourself? Oh, wait, let me get you a mic.
Hi, my name is Cameron Oglesby. I'm a student and a freelance environmental justice reporter focused on the Southeast U.S., so my question is a bit more directed towards the United States landscape. You highlighted that the 30 by 30 is more about protection and conservation. The way that I take that is, Ramadan goes to like the vast swaths of public lands in the western part of the country. If someone focused on the southeastern region, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago that highlighted the southeast as one of the originally one of the most biodiverse regions in the world. It's also been significant fodder for industry and exploitation, whether you're talking about Appalachia. Sorry, I'm not talking about the Great Dismal Swamp, some magnitudes of deforestation is taking place in the southeast. So, not to get on soapbox, how does the conversation, this 30 by 30 conversation, and just sort of your expertise, account for the protection of portions of the country that are already extremely exploited and that continue to serve as economic engines for a lot of the industry that we have to?
Thank you. And let's keep, because we're going to also address this in the next panel, right, Jennifer? So, why?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's an extremely good point. Obviously, a lot of places have been highly exploited and transformed, and there's lots and lots of people and equities and all this, you know, things like that. It says in that target three that, quote unquote, these areas which are being considered, quote, may include some forms of sustainable use, but must ensure that any sustainable use, where appropriate in such areas, is fully consistent with conservation outcomes. And then, of course, there's the whole target two, which is about restoration, and you know, which is obviously very relevant there. And I think it's a big thing for activists and journalists and others to hold everyone's feet to the fire, corporations and their state governments, national governments, you know, because there's going to be a lot of claims that areas of are sustainable use that are just basically use. And you know, I'm talking logging, mining, fishing. I've heard the United States proposal that any fisheries that actually has a management plan should be considered part of the 30%. You know, under the plan that was announced in 2021 by the Biden administration, even if the management plan is to catch every single fish, since there aren't any fish left, it would still be a management plan, right? You know, and so there's, you know, I think it's important in every community and place to think about what are your priorities and, you know, what are those land uses? What is the history of the land? How do people relate to it, and then figure out what's right there, what's going to be right in, you know, a sort of peri-urban area in southeastern United States is going to be real different from Kazakhstan or UA or any, you know, lots of places in the world. So I mean, it's a global thing, but people have to take hold of it at the local level, because everybody's own resources and their own environment is important for them. It's not just the Coral Triangle or the Amazon, you know, things like this. Those are globally important, but it's important right here in Boise, it's important everywhere, you know. And so It's basically, it doesn't belong to them, it should belong to people on the ground to figure out how to do this.
I got part of the question, but not all of it. Was it about sustainability?
Is that if, in a truly sustainable manner, if you can take degraded ag lands, for example, those are some of the most, those are some of the biggest opportunities for restoration. If we restore the productivity of degraded agricultural lands, then we're less likely to keep destroying other, more intact lands for the agriculture because we've destroyed the ag lands. So there's a connection between having higher functioning and higher ecologically productive ag lands so that we don't keep destroying other intact habitat as well. But we can certainly restore, and we can say we want to have good habitat everywhere in the United States, and we don't have to be, we don't have to look at that 30 by 30 exclusively at what is existing in good condition still. One other piece is to recognize that what we might think of as good condition may not be good condition because of shifting baselines. What did those lands look like when white people came? You know, in the Western United States, indigenous people were burning the whole West, and it was a gardened ecosystem. And we stopped burning, and what we look at as high functioning now might not be what was considered high functioning a couple hundred years ago. So there's culture as part of that ecosystem as well.
All right, I'll take a quick try. So North-South Nexus, they are interested in restoring arid grasslands because that's where these indigenous people live. One of their main goals is they do livability studies, and they're looking at sustainability because they don't want it to be a park and they don't want to move. They want to live there. They've been living there for 10,000 years. So that is a piece of it, is that they're doing restoration and rather than setting it aside and not having the idea that humans are separate from nature as opposed to with, they realize that they can live with it and it can be sustainable. And if you just take it from a, so they have livability studies where they are trying to have their communities just be there, even though it might be really hard to restore it because it's maybe hugely damaged. And then you, on the flip side, if you take a species, let's say we're just talking about wolves in Idaho, when the Nez Perce tribe was, they restored wolves onto the ecosystem, and we had, there was 1,300 wolves in the state about less than 5 or 6 years ago when there were zero in 1995. And now that they're delisted from the Endangered Species Act, we're down to about 400 because they're willy-nilly killing them. We've lost 900 wolves in the last 4 or 5 years in Idaho. Whereas if you go to Italy, which is, Italy's not that big of a country, it's about the size of some of our western states. Now they have 2,000 wolves in this particular park that's been set aside. And they're looking at, and there's, and it's communities and people live there, and they have figured out how to coexist with wolves in Italy, and they're doing a great job of it. Like, oh, we love our wolves. If you were talking to Idaho and or Montana or Wyoming, they don't love our wolves, and that's a problem.
People get up and they make their speech, like our friend from the DRC, and they, you know, and they make their general statements, and they say blah blah blah, you know, all these things, whether from all their different perspectives. And then when you want to try to come to an agreement, you got to take them aside. It's like I've had friends watch this stuff and say, how can you do this? It's so boring, you know. And I go, that's because all the interesting stuff happens on the sidelines. Go off and have a cup of coffee with them and say, okay, I heard your speech. What do you really want? Because this is what the European Union wants. This is what these other people want. You know. What is really behind this, you know? And they will say, well, you know, in the case of Gabon, as an easy example, you know, President Gabon is, feels a real connection with the forest elephants there. And when these armed groups came in from across the border about 10 years ago and started killing them from the ivory, he just, you know, sent in the army, basically chased them out. I mean, they were actually invaders from other places and things like this. And invested a huge amount, and they increased the number of forest elephants there. There are big issues there now between people and elephants out of the countryside. And that's a, you know, that's a whole other set of issues. But a lot of it has to do with basically personal experiences and leadership, as well as the economic interest, you know, the national interest. I mean, when we buy a car, economics comes into it. We're talking, you know, about cars. But people buy cars for reasons a lot, not just which is the best one and the best price and things like this. So there's a lot of different factors that go into how people behave, and that's and people who do negotiations, it's no different. I mean, Barack Obama got really interested in tigers, global tiger initiative. I remember I was so surprised. I was in government and said, well, the president wants, you know, papers on how's this global tiger summit going to work. This was something that was called by Vladimir Putin, actually, in 2010. And it turned out it was his daughters. They were studying tigers in school, and they made it a family project about wild tigers and everything like that. And so he just got really into it and said, okay, this is something we can make a difference, and something we can actually agree with Russia on and do something about. And as a result of that initiative, I think wild tigers in India, is one place I know, have doubled their population in the last 10 years or so. And that's another example. I mean, you know, people live with tigers and they can actually do it. I mean, there are ways to do it. I don't know if that answers, but that's one
of those. And I would add that there is a consequence to degraded ecosystems. And I think that's actually starting to be recognized, that actually what you lose from a degraded ecosystem is enormous. You may lose the plants that could actually feed into the crops that we eat because they contain the genetic material that's able to survive in very difficult circumstances. You could end up with a degraded water system, which could mean a loss to the ability of a city to sustain itself, or an agricultural system. I mean, I think there is a recognition of that. And a quick example, it goes back to this other thing, but I did some work in the Central Valley of California. And because the ecosystems catch up with you on this conservation question, and now, of course, there's a huge lack of water in California, despite all the atmospheric rivers. And so one of the consequences that farmers have had to retreat, and they're being obligated to actually take land out of commission because there's not enough water. So one of the interesting things about that is all these environmental thinkers are getting together and saying, we don't want this one farm over here, and this one farm over there, and this one farm over there, to take out separate pieces of marginal land that's not connected. We want to come up with a plan that connects all those now land taken out of agriculture so that you can recreate an ecosystem and allow animals to move and wildlife corridors and all this. So this is beginning to happen, and that is actually prompted by the very real degradation of those ecosystems because of the lack of water. So there's another way to think about it also. Anybody else? Sorry.
Hello, good morning. I'm Carla Mendes. I'm an investigative and feature reporter from Mobile Bay, Brazil. And I hear you, Dallas, about indigenous people being excluded from the decision-making process. I've been covering this very closely in the last 7 years. And I'm really interested in hearing how to address this and really having indigenous people as key actors in the plans for restoration and conservation.
Dallas.
Carla covers from Brazil, covers a lot of issues that involve indigenous people on their land and how we can, is ultimately interested in how we can better cover this question of how to protect our natural resources without excluding indigenous people and considering their perspective and their rights and ancestry also. Is that correct?
Sorry, if it wasn't clear. No, I'm really interested in how to fix this failure of not having indigenous people as key actors, like the 30 by 30 and a lot of really important decision-making process for the planet.
How to fix the problem of that they're not in the leadership, they're outside protesting and wanting in. that's a hard question. And because there are 5,000 different indigenous communities that have some of this traditional knowledge, who do you get to pick? When you're managing a particular species for an ecological community, I have to go back to the bison again. So the Nez Perce, there's 28 treaty hunting tribes that can, by their traditional treaties, can hunt. And so who gets to be part of that decision-making process? Currently, it's just the federal government that has been doing that, but now they're including Nez Perce tribe and the Shoshone-Bannock tribe. Well, I come from Fort Peck, and I am a treaty hunting tribe, so I want a piece of the leadership in that as well. So the door is just now beginning to open for indigenous leadership is a problem. That it's just now beginning to open is an opportunity. And so I think that just keep pushing that door open. It's hard because there's a new documentary out on Netflix called The Territory. I don't know if people are familiar with that, but that tribe was about to go extinct because of deforestation in the Amazon, and just enough protest, enough voices have opened the door for that tribe to move somewhat into a leadership position on the. And that's what it takes. I mean, I think it takes just direct action to, hey, you need to listen to us. And it takes a long time.
This is probably, we have time for these last two questions. And then
Benji Jones, I'm an environmental reporter at Vox. I think this question is mostly for Bethany about definitions. I think in the environmental movement, there are a lot of words, including restoration and nature-based solutions, and even conservation, that people don't use in the same way. And I'm just wondering if you have advice for journalists or the public for how do we all get on the same page about what these words mean.
Thanks, Benji. It's something that is near and dear to my heart, which is why I put definitions on the screen, even though Mark asked us not to use slides. I think it's about taking the definition seriously and being clear in your own reporting about what you mean when you say those terms. And so I don't think you should, I think we have an opportunity to, each time we reiterate those terms, we use those terms, to state what we mean in the story. It's not a lot of words. The definition of ecological restoration is short. You don't need the whole definition of ecosystem restoration. But I was talking with another reporter who was trying to, was writing a book about reforestation. Maybe she's here, I'm not sure. But I looked up the definition of reforestation. There are hundreds of definitions of reforestation. It's horrible. It's really, really horrible. When I say reforestation, I mean rebuilding a forest. For some people, it's a eucalyptus. And that's still reforestation. I would call that replanting, right? And so I think because there are so many different definitions, I think that SER's definition of ecological restoration is globally the main definition of ecological restoration. There's some variants, but that's the main one. But I would say make clear in your articles what you mean when you say it, and that will avoid the confusion. And so then, even if you use it differently than other people, if you say what you mean by it, it reduces the length of your definition.
In science, to some extent, in law, one strives for precision in definitions. In diplomacy, it's very different. You often strive for ambiguity, finding words which can be interpreted differently by different parties. That's how you get them to agree. So it can be very frustrating when you read a text which is negotiated and you say, well, what did they mean? They didn't agree on what they meant. So they picked a word that different people could go home and tell their bosses, we got what we wanted, even though they were completely different things. And that's one of the limitations of that kind of reform.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Zaya. I'm an environmental reporter from Mongolia. I work at a TV channel. My question is really for everyone who attended COP15 in Canada. I personally covered COP27 in Egypt in November, and what I noticed there was that when I was interviewing people from developing countries, they tended to, you know, blame all the developed nations for not doing enough, which is true. But I also noticed that they were not trying to do anything with their own resources. Like when I look up the budget for the ministries of the environment, they tend to be the lowest. You know, they don't have enough money for their ministry of environment. So my question to you is, do you think that attitude from developing countries is legitimate? Like, what did you notice in COP15? Because my understanding at COP27 was that people from developing countries tend not to, you know, they tend to blame the developed countries, but they're not trying to do enough with their own resources. What is your opinion on that?
Two quick things, and this is an old phenomenon. I was actually at COP1, but obviously been back a long way and up into, and this is right, and I used to be a negotiator with this, and two issues would always come up, and this is like wearing a hat in the United States negotiator. One is, if you don't ask for the money, you can't get more from the North. And your finance minister, when he sits down with the World Bank or the USAID, never asks for money for the environment. It's always for the infrastructure, roads and bridges. You've got to get those people. I'm on your side. I'd love for us to be giving you more money, but you guys don't ask. So people who have the power to actually run these things are not on board yet. So sort of mainstream positions is important. The other is the enabling conditions, talking about crime and corruption, you know, organized nature crime. This is what I do in my day job, is, you know, thinking about these structural things happening that, you know, it doesn't. Would you spend money on saving carbon in the Peruvian Amazon right now, in the forest when it's just rife with all sorts of organized crime and lots of corruption? No investor, public or private, in their right mind would put money in some of those places until one can get a handle on that very bad stuff, which is going on. It's the other kinds of crime and corruption. Anyone's interested in that, that's kind of the main thing. And my colleague, Krista Karsh, is somewhere over there. Longest and reddest hair here, I'm sure. So if you want to talk about this afterwards, we have lots of things to talk about, you know, there. But those are two things that we would always raise, that, you know, if the enabling conditions aren't right, then it's not going to be useful, and you've got to ask for them.
I guess, I mean, part of it is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, if you look around this country, there are native reservations who are the poorest of the poor in a rich country. And then you get into the global south, same thing. So both COPs, climate and biodiversity, I think they really need to elevate the level of reparations and compensation. And that needs to be a really high focus. Now, I know they're doing it a little bit in climate COP, but if you're poor, you're Ministry of Finance is probably not going to go ask for that money for biodiversity or for climate when you're trying to feed your people. And so that's a huge discrepancy. Reparations and compensation really is not really, in my opinion, coming to the surface the way it needs to.
I would add, from a conversation I had with somebody at the World Bank, which was, it's similar to what Chip is saying, he's going to meet with people to talk about funding things, and he wants to meet with the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Health, but the only person he gets to meet with is the Minister of Environment, because he's there from the forestry program. But if you fix the forests, then you're gonna have cleaner water, and you're gonna have less people getting cholera or whatever it is. So that intersection of human health and well-being with environment and biodiversity is something that can change the conversations that are happening in not just the Global South ministries, but also in the United States, in the North, where we separate these things. And again, we separate that our health and well-being has anything to do with the environment. environment. If we start, one of the other things we see with restoration is it can reduce conflict. So if you're investing in restoring that river and you no longer have a water security problem, you have less conflict, and then you have less crime, and then people are more secure. So making those connections, that environment is not over here by itself, but it has to be integrated, will enable ministers in these other countries to think about investing in their natural capital in a different way. Are they doing it? I haven't done a study of, you know, how, which countries are and which aren't, but I think that there's information that can broaden that discussion to make it more likely.
Thank you. All right, so I think this is, I'm going to have one little twist to respond, and then we're going to wrap it up. But I think there's actually a difference, and it's an important conceptual difference, between the climate and biodiversity negotiations. River, they're completely connected to one another. I mean, you need a biodiverse planet to respond to climate change to sequester carbon, it's clear. But from a negotiating point of view, which is your, I think, the heart of your question, the role of local ministries of environment, there is a fundamental difference. The money that they're seeking from developing countries, is to not do what we in developed countries have done for two centuries, which is to develop along fossil fuel lines and in return to be compensated for that. To put it crudely, that is what we requested. When it comes to biodiversity, these largely speaking, now moving outside of North America to the whole world, is because these are where the centers of biodiversity are. These are where the resources are. So when you talk about reparations, Dallas mentioned that too. The part of the issue there is how do we, who are the holders of biodiverse resources in the world, be compensated for what we have provided to all of you over 200 years. It's a very different dynamic when it comes to the financial questions. And just keep that in mind, conceptually speaking, I think it's an important distinction. So I think we are reaching the end of our session here. If people have a final comment, or we should just wrap it. Okay, so hopefully some great lines of inquiry for everybody here, broadly put. We're all here. I'm going to turn it over to our panelists if they have a final word, a minute each. Clarify things, and then we are on schedule, and we want to keep moving because we're going to move to the next panel, which would be equally, if not more, interesting. So thank you so much, and here we go.
Thanks. Thanks for listening. Thanks for inviting me. And I would just say, from my perspective, and when we talk about climate, we talk about biodiversity, we talk about these crises, I just hope you leave with this understanding that we have some solutions too. We talked about a lot of hard things today, but restoration, ecological restoration, specifically we would argue standards-based, well-implemented, well-designed restoration can actually help us turn the tide. And it's hopeful, it's restoration is an antidote to despair. It is something we can do as individuals, as countries, as communities, and it can help transform our relationship with nature and with each other and help us get to a different place where we have a healthy planet to live on. So I encourage you to learn about restoration, report about it. It's not always conflict-based, but people want to hear good stories too, so go for it.
Yeah, thanks for letting me replace Norma. Norma is with the Indigenous Leadership Institute, so I would look this up. I looked this up last night. I highly encourage you to know that she would have been here and actually had an idea of what we were going to talk about. I did a bunch of research last night, and all the blue, right? All you have to do is Google Indigenous biodiversity, and you're going to get links all over the place. The COP is one thing, and we've got the 30 by 30, which most Indigenous people around the world are not in favor of. Then you got the UN saying, you really need to bring Indigenous people into this. And they've been saying it for a very long time. And so go ahead and just Google all that. I'm sorry Norma couldn't be here, but I think that's it. I'm going to turn it over.
Thanks, Dallas. And you started with a car analogy, so I'll end with a very short and quick car analogy. And this has to do with how different, what they call stakeholders, you know, indigenous peoples and states, how they interact is in making policy at all levels. And if you own a car and I steal that car, I wouldn't say that we are both then stakeholders in what to do with that car. You know, it's basically, it's your car, and I stole it, you know? And so if I said, well, we're both stakeholders now, let's have a discussion about this, I think you would probably say, well, no, it's my car, actually, and I think you should just give it back and you're paying for it, you know? And I did not make that up. I heard that from an indigenous friend of mine in Latin America. I thought it was really quite good. And that's something to also keep in mind. You'll hear a lot of this language about we're all sitting around the table as stakeholders, but we come with very different sets of privilege and rights and all sorts of different things. And you need to really think about that as you think about how we depict and characterize how we're going to go forward.
Yes, huge thank you to all of our speakers, especially Dallas, who so gamely stepped in at the last minute. And we didn't actually get to talk a lot about wildlife coexistence, but I encourage you to also look at the International Wildlife Coexistence Network, which sounds like a really cool organization. I have sneakily updated the agenda for this session on HUVA. I don't know if y'all noticed, if we compared it a week ago to what it is today, it's all accelerated by about 15 minutes, because I wanted to build in enough time to switch panels and sort of take a break in the afternoon. So we're going to do a quick turnaround, about 10 minutes to get coffee, stretch your legs, and then we're going to set up the next panel. So I will see you all back here in 10 minutes. Thanks so much.
I don't know. Thank you.
we're gonna